Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Sabbe satama ranti chama ring su chama visare tate wahang marisami nati mayeta sang sayo ti. Which those people who know a little bit of Pali will remember that's one of my favorite chants, which I do chant at funerals. Sabbe satama ranti chala, all beings will die. Ring su chama visare, they will die. Tatewa hang marisami, and knowing that I will die, and that's one thing I can be totally certain of. And obviously the talk, having come off my lovely, peaceful, beautiful retreat, having a wonderful time, nice and peaceful, and of course I did know that Craig, Avanagarika, had passed away, had died, and that was fine for me, but I was a bit disturbed that a few people have their reaction to a death when they come close to it. So it seems that it's a good idea that I talk a little bit about death, seeing how it's so close to everybody. And the funeral was just yesterday. So it is wonderful that we have such an opportunity. It's a gift which Craig gave to everybody here. Actually to come very close, up front, personal, in your face, to have a death. And it's something which, you know, I was taught, and I appreciate the truth and the benefit of having that as a wonderful example for us. It's very easy for us to read books, it's very easy to listen to talks. When something, an experience like that happens right in front of you, it's so much different than any talk or reading it in a book. When it's right there, it's real. You can touch it, you can see the corpse. There's somebody who was talking to you yesterday and today they can't talk anymore. They're cold, they're stiff. And coming up close to that death, it is an eye-opener for yourself to see just how you react to such an experience. Many times if you'll say, oh yeah, I've been to funerals, I know we will all die, that's just so obvious, but it just shows you that your understanding of the Dhamma can be sometimes so superficial. In other words, it doesn't really go to the heart, to the core, and when something like that really does happen, it just shows you that sometimes people say, oh, their Dhamma just goes out the window. It means it wasn't real Dhamma which you had, it was just so sort of on the surface. And, you know, you have this opportunity in this life. You have the opportunity coming to a monastery like this, or Dhammasara Monastery, you have the opportunity, you know, actually to transcend, you know, these attachments, these obstacles, these defilements, this ignorance, this delusion, this lack of understanding, you know, which causes you to have something like a natural event, like a death, and just not understand it. And overreact to it, and just get very upset with it. Yes, out there in the world, people just do not understand the Dhamma, and they do get upset. One of my favorite sayings from the suttas is that what the enlightened ones say is happiness, the world says is suffering. What the enlightened ones say is suffering, the world says it's happiness. In fact, you know, the people who understand the Dhamma see things in a totally different way, the opposite way. And where people actually think you are cold, you are heartless, you have no compassion, you have to accept that's going to happen because they see things in a totally different way than someone who understands the Dhamma does. And there'll be few people, and you have to understand and accept this, there'll be few people in this world ever will understand the Dhamma. Most people will be just running around, like they say, like chickens with their heads cut off. They're not really understanding what's really happening in this world. And you have the opportunity to really understand this. Of course, sometimes it can be tough. I mean, knowledge, understanding, realization, it doesn't come, you know, without pain of giving up the old attachments, with a bit going through fear. Well, that's one of the reasons why a lot of people just haven't got the guts and courage to do it. You know, but here you have the opportunity. You have the chance to have everything put in perspective. Because that's what a death does. It's up close, it's personal, you can touch it, you can see it, you can smell it sometimes. And it just starts to challenge you very deeply. And you have like two choices. One is just to run away and pretend it didn't happen. To fantasize, to dream, to read, distract yourself, anything to get away from facing something which is really, really testing and challenging you. And if you do that, you'll just be running away for the rest of your life and the next life and the one afterwards. And always suffering because you've not really got the courage and the guts to really go in there and find out what the problem is. And to test yourself out. And you have to do that sooner or later, and the sooner it is the better. The sooner you go to the dentist to get the rotten tooth out and fixed up, the less pain it's going to be for you. So you look at that, what's wrong with dying? You know that sometimes, that we call it like the messenger of the Dhamma. Sometimes I was thinking when I was blissing out in my cave, having some wonderful times on retreats, you know, deep meditation, having a great time. Sometimes you were just, after Craig's death, I sort of contemplated, now I suppose what would happen if I came out of retreat and started displaying psychic powers for you? No real stuff, you know, not messing around, just, you know, if I just levitated right in front of the camera for you. And if Ajahn Appy just burst into flames. And if Ajahn Brahmani just walked through the wall. Real psychic powers, solid stuff, not just you can read my mind, which most people just imagine it's the case, but really solid ones. Would that be very useful? It would just be entertainment, that's all. It would just be just feeding your, you know, desire and craving for another new experience, something interesting, something fascinating. But it doesn't really challenge you as much as the psychic experience of seeing a dead body does. That's a teaching. Which is one of the reasons why the Buddha told the monks, don't display those things, they're just titillating people. They're just exciting them. It's like being a person on a freak show. That's all it is. It doesn't really serve a person to progress on this path of letting go, of wisdom, of detaching, of fading away, of liberation, of peace, of freedom, of the end of rebirth. Those sorts of powers, displaying them, doesn't really do much at all. But seeing a dead body and coming close to that, now that does have power to confront. I've often said to people when they come telling me about their meditation, that you will come across fear very often in the path of meditation, in the spiritual path. And whenever you do come across fear, please face it, walk towards it, and walk through that fear. Don't run away. And sometimes I just say, if ever you do see a ghost, walk towards them. Don't run away. I remember just an experience years ago, not a ghost experience. One of the times when I was teaching in Bunbury Jail, 30 years ago, 28 years ago, sometime around then. And in the afternoon, I used to go down to the beach to meditate. I told you a story about those two beautiful girls, but this is a more interesting story. I was meditating on the beach, just by myself, quietly in the afternoon, because the talk at the prison was in the evening, and I'd stay overnight in Bunbury, come back on the train the following morning. And so, just enjoying myself meditating quietly, I heard the whiz of a stone come past my head. And then another one. Somebody was throwing stones at me. And then I heard these kids shout out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" Because this was a time, you know, in a spiritual world when followers of the Bhagavan, Rajneesh, were becoming quite popular. And he was actually trying to set up a community in Western Australia. And his offsider, I think Ma Sheila, if I remember it correctly, came over to Perth. She was great TV because she was just so outrageous. And if somebody was respectful and peaceful and wise and sensible, of course, that's not good TV. But when you go on the TV and you sort of swear at people and just act really terribly, everybody likes watching that TV show. And so, you know, she became well known and totally hated. And that's why when I was sitting there in the brown robe, in a time when people didn't know the difference between a follower of Rajneesh and a Buddhist monk, that's why they shouted out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi," and started throwing stones at me. And, you know, big stones. And so as soon as I realized what was going on, I just carried on meditating until one stone came pretty close to my ear. And realized that, you know, just sitting it out is not a good idea. So I stood up, turned around, and started walking towards the stone throwers, which was the last thing they expected. They expected me to get up and run away. But I walked towards them so they could get a better aim. And as I walked towards them, it was an unexpected response. And their response, about 13, 14-year-old boys, they all ran away from me. They're the ones which were running, and I didn't have any stones at all. And as I walked towards them, there was one boy stood his ground. He's obviously the leader of the pack. And I went right up to him, and I explained to him, "I'm a Buddhist monk, I'm not a Rajneeshi. It's a different sort of path, a totally different religion. And I'm a peaceful person." And I started talking to them about Buddhism for about 10 minutes, and then they went one way, went the other way, they said sorry. They didn't realize who I was. But I always remember that whenever you have anything frightening, sometimes, not always, sometimes it's good to walk towards that fear and see what happens. If you see a ghost, don't run away from them, walk towards the ghost. If you have any fear in your meditation, don't run away. Walk towards that fear. And if there's something about death which you feel very uncomfortable with, don't run away, walk towards it. Because we're in this life to learn, to train, to transcend, not just to become more and more stupid. And don't ever say, "I can't do this, I'm not up to that standard yet." That is again just Mara talking to you. You all are up to that standard. You've been reborn as a human being, you're high beings. So go towards it. Don't ever run away from fear. Otherwise fear will get stronger and stronger in you and end up controlling you. So we walk towards it. So we walk towards, what's the problem with this death and dying? We touch the corpse. We feel it. We imagine ourselves in there. And this is a beautiful thing to do. Because what happens is you realize that could be you. And you realize it's no one to blame, no one's fault. This is the truth of life. Any time, any place, any age, any person. And they do die. And maybe it's because, you know, I've been around long enough, because I saw death when I was young and saw death all the time. You know, when I was in Thailand, there's a local cremation ground. That was actually wonderful to see a dead body usually once a week, and to go up to the pyre, which was an open pyre, and actually touch the body, feel it, and see it burn. And that's a person you saw the day before who offered you alms food. And I was a young boy, the young man, exactly the same age as you, the young girl, which was very pretty, the old ladies, they were all up there in their coffins. And we did used to have people visiting and staying, just like we have here. In those days, many of the visitors were, you know, people of the Peace Corps, the British VSO, and other people doing volunteer work in the community, and they'd come and stay to get a Buddhist experience, you know, with Westerners, they can get some understanding what was going on. When these volunteers in Thailand for a short time went to a Thai monastery, they couldn't understand a thing which was going on. It's a waste of time for them. They come to Western monastery, they got, you know, a lot of understanding. And I remember many, many times, they're talking to these visitors and leading them up, come up and see the corpse. No, I can't. Come up! And I had to cajole and beg them and encourage them. And they came up, and for many of them it was the first time they'd seen a real corpse. Not ones like you see here. Because the ones we see here in Australia, they've been embalmed. Makeup. They inject all chemicals into their skin to make their skin look exactly the same as if it's alive. A real dead body is grey and pale. And it looks very different than, say, what you saw with Craig. That was a painted-up corpse. It wasn't a real one. Seeing the real ones, you know, it has a huge effect upon you. It's a Dhamma. It's something which you see and you never forget, internalize it, you touch it. And what effect does it have on you? The effect it has on you is, you know, that you know that you're subject to that as well, so you realize that in this life, it's not going to go on forever. So that's obvious, Ajahn Brahm, but you still assume that you've got another day tomorrow, and the next day. You know, you're anagarikas, you think you're going to ordain. You may not make it that far. Like Craig, novices, monks, you've got all these plans of what you're going to do. And this death gets in the way of all plans. It destroys your future, or rather this fantasy you have about the future, which is one of the biggest obstacles to happiness and peace and freedom, the perception of the future. We waste so much time planning, thinking, just fantasizing, where we're going to go, what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, what we're going to say to that person tomorrow, what we're going to cook. And that's what stops you becoming enlightened. Just because you're not here when life is happening. You're always somewhere else. And when you see a dead body, it really brings you into present moment. You're here and you don't know how many more present moments you've got. So you can't waste them. It's amazing just how heedless we are and how much time we do waste. The range retreat, it's almost over two-thirds over. Short time before you know it, we'll be doing the Katina ceremonies. We finished. So fast. Being a monk, is it 41 or 42 rains now? It's gone, was it 15, so it's, yeah, 42 this year. It's gone so fast. And I realise that I'm not going to have another 42 rains left. My death is coming fast, as is yours. And don't go thinking, yours is coming really fast, Ajahn Brahm, because you eat bacon and condensed milk. It doesn't work that way. Okay, you can joke around and stuff, but death happens at the most unexpected time to the most unexpected people. The old sick ones, they tend to linger on and last. It's the healthy ones who suddenly appear, they're gone. I've seen that too often. And this is the case. So don't ever think that you can control your life and death. It is out of control. One thing which we know will happen, but we know that we cannot tell that date. It's impossible to know. It's what you know for sure and what you don't know for sure. What you know for sure is death, it's going to happen. What you don't know for sure is when. So don't assume you have lots of time left. And if it is 20 years is not much. It goes very fast. Before you know it, it's there. That gives you a sense of urgency. And by urgency, I don't mean getting sort of be a control freak, because that is one of the dangers which people have when they find out urgency. Okay, I better get my act together, I better do it now. No, it's the urgency to start doing some letting go. It's the urgency to realize that, you know, that you're not in control, that your body and much of your life belongs to nature, not to you. And why don't you see that body belongs to nature, not to you? And all your exercises and pills and food and diets and stuff like that, yeah, they're helpful, but you cannot rely on them. Don't think because you eat healthy, what people call healthy food, that's a bit of a myth. No food is healthy. It's all going to cause your death. Never think that you are exempt. This is the problem with people. They always think that you're special. We always think that we're different. But I'm not like other people. And, you know, you see that someone like Craig, you're like that. That's one of the things which really hits you. If it's someone you've known and lived with, and very close to, you know that he's not different than you. And that's one of the reasons why it really shocks us. If it's somebody outside, we think, oh yes, you know, they're different. When it's one of us, one of our community, then that makes it, that's me in that box. It could have been me. And it gives you a sense of, you have to let go, of urgency in this letting go. And stop, please excuse me, stop pissing around in this monastery. Stop messing up. You haven't got time to do this. Somebody says something which upsets you, for goodness sake, let it go. You haven't got time to get angry, to get upset, to have all these thoughts which are going up in your mind. You haven't got time for that. You've got time, whatever somebody says, if there's something stupid, that's their problem, it's not yours. Your job, you have urgency to let it go, keep your mind peaceful, keep kindness, and remember it's so easy to be kind, compassionate to nice people. People who are nice, peaceful, never challenge you. It's so easy to be compassionate to a nice cat, but can you be compassionate to a snake? Can you be compassionate to the flies or the ticks? Can you be compassionate towards your enemies? And that's testing you. It's about time you get in there and start being compassionate to your people you don't like or people who upset you. They're your best teachers. And don't run away from that. Face it. It can be done. It has been done many times. And hopefully you've seen examples of that. And once you can understand that, you understand this is what I'm going to do as well. And so it gives you the urgency to let go of those coarse things which you should have let go of a long time ago. Many of you have been practicing for a long time. It's about time you got your act together and don't allow other people to control your emotions. Simple thing. You know, this time of year, the magpies swoop, you know, the dogs bark, you know, the cats do what the cats do. This is just what people do. It's their nature. So don't think that the nature of this world is something wrong, that people are something wrong. It's just what they do, it's their conditioning. And try and find a dog which doesn't bark. Try and find a bird which doesn't make a sound, which doesn't poop on everything. But don't do that. So when you accept things and their nature, because all you're really doing, getting angry, is asking something from the world which it can never give you. That old saying, asking from this world something it can never give you. That is suffering. So every time you feel upset, you're suffering, you're angry. So what am I asking for which this world can never give you? You can't always live in Dhammasala monastery with arahats. Because you're not one yourself. You know, you're living with human beings, you know, with their defilements. You can't expect in the kitchen everyone to be so soft and peaceful and be as wise as I am. That's what you say. I'm not mean Ajahn Brahm, because everything, why can't people be, see what I can see and do what I can do? You're living with human beings who are on the path, practicing, trying their very best, but they're going to upset you if you let them. Because no one can upset you if you understand that you're asking from the world what it can't give you. If you remember what the world is, and you live within the laws and natures of this world, and never ask what it can't give you, you'll find peace anywhere. It's not the kitchen which causes you suffering. Just like Ajahn Chah used to say, it's not the noise disturbs you. It's you who disturb the noise. Brilliant, beautiful, deep teaching. Those are the teachings which is about death. It's not that death disturbs you. You are disturbing death. Asking from this world something it can't give you. You're not accepting it. You're not making peace with it. You try to change it, you know, you try to be a little god and change things according to what you want. So when we understand not to ask in this world something it can't give us, it can't give me another day. I don't know. Give me this moment, that's all this world can give me, that's all I ask for. I can't ask for everyone to sort of always say kind and do nice things for me and realize that all I want to do is sit in my hut and meditate all day. I can't accept that. Because people will always be bothering me. I accept that. I'm at peace with that. Because I never ask from Santi, from Newbury, from the committee, from Dhammasala, from the monks, the Anagarikas, the lay people. I don't ask anything from anybody. That expect. That way you can be peaceful. So by understanding what's going on here, the death experience is a great benefit. That makes this retreat one of the best ever in this monastery. Somebody died. It would be wonderful if somebody can volunteer to die at Dhammasala. You missed out, ladies. Or someone can volunteer to die next year. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant thing to do. It just really brings the whole Dhamma home. It makes it real. It makes it alive. It's not a theory anymore. This is important for you. Just like it said in the sutta there, these six indriyas, they're on fire. Fire, okay? It's danger. Your body is on fire. Life is on fire. If there's a fire going on, you don't just sit and say, oh, it's only a fire. Oh, it's okay, I'm just going to go and just get a job. I'm just going to go back home. I'm going to watch a movie. I'm just going to just read a nice book. It's on fire. It's on fire, mate. You better do something about it. And what do? You sit down and stop messing around. You become peaceful. You meditate. You understand this Dhamma. This Dhamma is the most beautiful thing you can possibly have. I was just blissing out on my retreat. I've been a monk for 41, 42 years now. It works. It's beautiful. nothing in the world bothering you at all. Deep, deep, deep stillness. And in that stillness, totally happy, content, at peace with everything. I want that, you to have that. But you won't have that if you worry about petty politics and who said what and why they said it and try controlling people and getting upset about this and upset about that. For goodness sake, put things in perspective. What's really important is peace and kindness. Everything else is just by the way. We're not here to have a monastery run like a US Marine camp, like a boot camp, where everyone gets told what to do and how to do it. This is a place, a spiritual place of peace, kindness, respect for the way of the world, the nature, never expecting anything from anybody. That's why, you know, as a leader of this monastery, you always want to try and have this monastery open for all types of people, as much as you possibly can, so everybody feels they have a place in here. You don't have to have everybody being great meditators, or great scholars, or great builders. You want to see everyone wants to, I want them to be welcome here. Because if they feel welcome here, accepted, at peace here, and not sort of cajoled or forced or given a hard time by anyone, then they can meditate. Then they find peace. The way we treat others is the way we treat our mind. And if we can learn how to treat our mind with peace, with kindness, and most importantly with patience. I say to a few people in interviews, that was one of my biggest themes on the last 15 days of my retreat. Patience. Patience just to be here and to wait in this moment for things to happen. If I wanted them to happen, if I had a timeline and goals, they wouldn't happen at all. I've been there, done that too often. So for 15 days I did nothing, I was just patient and waited in this moment without any expectations, wanting, without any timelines. And that's why you bliss out. The mind becomes so incredibly still and peaceful. And okay, you can read about stillness, you can hear other people talk about it, but it's not your own. When you're right there in the stillness and the peace, now you understand what this path is all about. I forget who I was talking to, but even when I was mentioning, I think it was a lay person, they were talking about the jhanas. And talking about the first jhana, one of the things when I read the suttas, and it really hit me hard, you know, when you saw the Buddha said the happiness of first jhana is sambodhi, sukha. And I know partly sambodhi sukha means enlightenment, happiness. Basically it was saying the same happiness as enlightenment. It's sambodhi. And so that can't be right, because, you know, the jhanas, you always know I'm on about these things, that because they're wonderful places to be, really recommended. Not dangerous at all. Great place to be. So don't be afraid of them. If they happen, just welcome them. Wow. But when he said that, I know they're not exactly enlightenment, but they're really close to it and just a great, one of the most important causes for enlightenment. But this is what it feels like. So enlightenment, nibbana, you know, it's not a word. It's not some concept or something which happened thousands of years ago, which is not available and open for you. You feel it. You're experiencing it. At least some bodhisukha. And for those of you who keep asking the question, is it possible these days for people to become enlightened? You got the answer. You feel it. You know exactly what it is. And at least you have an understanding what this word actually means. You can't get that understanding from the books. The books get you so far, close, but to get the real experience, like the real experience of death, you have to touch somebody who's dead. Really, really almost just get inside their body, a dead body. climb in the coffin with them, figuratively speaking. It's the same way to understand what Nibbana is. Climb into the coffin of jhanas. Feel it. And even if you don't get into the jhanas, you feel this incredible stillness and peace. And the bliss of that. The bliss of a totally different flavour you've ever experienced before. But there, now, you understand what we're here for. And basically there's a few monasteries you can do this. And so you are lucky being here. So a lot of you don't realise what you've stumbled across. Please do not give it away that easily. Please look at sort of the death of Craig. That's you soon. Not that long. Don't waste your time. As the Buddha said, the doors of the deathless are open. And you're crazy not to walk through it. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of sacrifice for you. It's going to be tough at first. But the toughness, the sacrifice, the suffering is worth it. It gets less and less and less. The peace, the bliss gets more and more and more. It's tough for me too. Sometimes monks come and say this to me. They say, oh, you were born in jhanas. You know, I'm sure that, you know, when you're a young boy, you know, you never did anything wrong. You talk to my brother, that guy sort of Bernard, he should have, you know, when that conference, he should have said more of the things which I really did get up to. You know, totally drunk on that scholar's dinner when I was there. You know, the scholars, okay, here we go. Because it's about time I did something which is totally uninspiring, just to show you where I came from. I did come from a poor family, it was scholarships all the way. So I think the top 5% or 10% of people in Cambridge I was in. So I was in a scholar there. So you had a scholar's dinner with all of the professors. They got a free passage in there, plus, you know, the few scholars. And that was a 9-course meal to start off with. 9 courses. The best was the biggest dinner in the whole of the university. Yeah. Each college, scholars' dinner. The top. They served the very best there. And the servants were all dressed in butler suits. You know, tails. You know, just like you see in the movies. The real thing. And they'd always come on your right side, never on the left side, to fill your glass. And it literally was, if your glass of wine was less than half, immediately it got filled. And they were hovering behind you, maybe one butler for about 3 or 4 diners. And after that was finished, you know, different wine for every course, then into the old library. There were cigarettes, if you want cigarettes, 3 glasses, one for port, one for claret, one for Madeira. This was not rubbish stuff. This was the best. And they were also bananas and fruit. Ajahn Lafi would have liked it. And then they came with the goblet. You know, like big goblet, you know, it was not gold, it was silver, with all these jewels in it. And I don't remember what particular wine, I think it was actually claret, one of the wines, filled into it. I mean, that was a big mug. I don't think any of you, and I've seen some of the mugs you have for breakfast over here, mugs. It was about twice that size. And you had to drain it. Drain the whole lot and then say the college toast in Latin afterwards. Okay. And that was what I got into. And I don't know what I was saying when I was totally drunk, but all the college servants, they looked upon me the following day. I said something wrong. Something stupid. I think, if I remember correctly, I had a girlfriend called Louise at the time, and I went around saying, I want to screw Louise. When you're drunk, you don't know what you're doing. That's what they told me afterwards. Did I say that? So that is where I came from, okay? So I wasn't this pure, compassionate, kind, wonderful being. I was as stupid as anybody else. But, you know, you had this feeling that this first time I meditated, this taste, this tiny taste, this was peaceful. Something you could recognize, like in the distance. This is important, this is interesting. It's worth following. And maybe the thing which really helped me, that I had commitment. And I think even Ajahn Chakra, the first abbot here, used to notice that. He said, whenever you do something, you follow it through to the end. You never give up. You know, building work. And anything else I did, studies, learning the Parimokkha, you know, doing the Vinaya, even ordaining bhikkhunis. Whatever I start, I don't finish until it's done. I mean, really done. And that's one of my characters. And I think that is something which I was born with. When I'm going to get drunk, I'm going to really get drunk. Well, it's to the end. And it was a stupid end afterwards. And that was actually the last time I took any alcohol after that, when I woke up the following morning and just feeling like death. And people were going around saying, oh, what a wonderful time that was. And I was rebellious enough, that was not, I may have been a wonderful time, I don't know, I can't remember anything. But what I do know now, that I feel disgusting and terrible. And this is where you stop and change, you learn. But you at least had some inclination that this was really important. And of course, you know, you saw your father die, you saw other people die. I remember just when he did die, just going to his room, touching him, shaking him. It's really important to actually feel death and not go away from it. And this was your father. And you know how much I love my father, you know, opening the door of your heart story. You know, he's a really, really important man for me. I learned a lot from him. He was the guy who always said his father was a bastard. What do you call your own father a bastard for? Because they explained to me just how he'd whip everybody with his belt, get drunk, and then just beat up his wife, my father's mother. He hated him for that. But that's why, you know, he said, I can't hit you at all anymore. I've seen it, I know what it's like. He's a great man. I still remember many memories of him. He died. It's great to be close to something like that. And that made sort of, you know, a lot of change in the way you look at life. What's really important? What's not important? And sometimes I see people wasting their time on stupid, unimportant things. Getting upset and angry over just simple, stupid, important, unimportant things. I'll finish off, going on too long. There's an old story, it's not in Opening the Door of Your Heart, it's in another book which I read when I was in Thailand. And about the difference, I said this to someone the other day, the difference between an irritation and a problem. So please understand this story, it's a brilliant story. It was this guy, he was backpacking, as they say it these days, in Europe, in I think the early 1960s. So, you know, just, you know, those days, you can get a job somewhere, cheap job, get a bit of money, when you've got enough, you carry on your journey, experiencing Europe. So this American, he was in, I think, Vienna, in Austria somewhere, so probably was Vienna. And he was working, you know, washing dishes in a restaurant, the sort of jobs which backpackers would get. Washing dishes, and the nice thing about getting a job in a restaurant was not only you got paid, you got free food. So then, you know, that was, you know, saving a bit of money. All you had to pay for is lodgings, you know, cheap lodgings. So I could save up money by not having to pay for food. But the owner of the restaurant made a big mistake and ordered too much sauerkraut. Now I know that someone like Amandus would love a restaurant like that. But this was an American, and he didn't really like sauerkraut. And when the owner of the restaurant told all of the staff that from now on, if anyone wants a free meal, they have to have sauerkraut, has to get rid of it. If you want anything else, you have to pay for it. And this American, being like an American, you know, about, you know, freedom, fairness, said, This is unfair. You know, when I joined here, you said I could have a free meal. Yeah, you can have a free meal, have as much sauerkraut as you want. That's not what you said. You know, I demand that I have a proper meal. You know, whatever I want, because that was part of the contract. That's what you said. And you got very, very upset. And that's when the cook, this old cook, came up to him and took him aside and said, young man, I'm going to teach you the difference between an irritation and a problem. And he said, about 10 years ago, I was in Auschwitz. Every morning I woke up, I didn't know whether I would be taken to the gas chambers that day. Many of my relations, people I loved, my friends, they disappeared. I was sent to work instead. I survived. He said, being in Auschwitz is a problem. Sauerkraut is an irritation. Remember that. That was a brilliant story. Because being in the kitchen in Bodhinyana Monastery is an irritation. It is not a problem. Remember that. Having a cough, a cold, not getting the right food, whatever it is, not getting enough retreats, it's an irritation. It's not a problem. If you understand that, you have a much more peaceful life. Thank you for listening.
Hello, my name is
Very good. Arahant Sama Sambuddho Sukhati Pano Bhagavan.